that time again when we say goodbye, but only until next week. We look forward to having you join us next time on Modern Jazz Today, where we will be presenting today's artists, cutting their teeth and cutting the edge of sound. Join myself, Carrie Gaffney, and
Jeff Williams
when it's time to tune in and turn up again. We look forward to it.
Attention Ontario pickleball players. The Maple Leaf Pickleball Club invites you to the Smash for a Cause charity tournament in support of Jumpstart Charities. This action-packed day of competition and community spirit takes place at the Fairgrounds Racquet Club in Hamilton, Ontario, Sunday, April 26th. Whether you're playing for fun or for the podium, there are prizes to be won. And don't miss the battle for the coveted Maple Leaf Cup. Smash for a Cause. Register now at MapleLeafPickleball.org. That's MapleLeafPickleball.org.
Well, good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, this is actually one of the very few times during the year where I bring in a pre-record just because I can't be at the studio this afternoon. So what I've decided to do, a kind of short on brand new events and things to bring in this week, I'm going to go back to Kingston Writers Fest, September 28th, 2023, Kingston Writers Fest event called Fire Weather. And the reason is because the book that I'm going to tell you here, or mention to you, I guess I should say, here in just a minute, pertains to the wildfires that were happening, raging in Fort McMurray. And I mean, it's a broader scope than that, the book is, but with wildfires now kind of starting already this season, I thought, you know what, I really enjoyed that conversation at Kingston Writers Fest that day. And I thought, you know what, this is kind of maybe apropos to play this afternoon. So in the first hour, again, from a September 28th, 2023 Kingston Writers Fest event called Fire Weather, you'll hear author John Valant in discussion with Warren Mabee and referencing Valant's book called Fire Weather, The Making of a Beast. And as I mentioned, the discussion centered around ideas about North America's oil industry, climate science, and how and why the devastation from forest fires is growing each year. This is actually a 90-minute discussion and will run uninterrupted at least halfway through the second hour. So in the second hour, you'll hear first the final 30 minutes of that Kingston Writers Fest discussion begun at the top of the hour. And then following that, you'll hear a bit of music and, well, you're going to hear a bit of local information, no music today, a bit of local information about calls for submissions and upcoming events and things like that. Just my usual start of the hour announcement. Occasionally some poetry, spoken word, and music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. Second announcement as well, and that is because I won't have a chance to work in the usual end-of-the-hour announcement because the event you'll be hearing in a couple of minutes will run straight through it. I'll announce it now. And it's just that it's just a reminder that every week both hours of this show are uploaded to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com, and they will remain there for 3 years. I do usually get that uploaded by about 7 o'clock, but this evening I'm tied up as well, so it's going to be much later, maybe even tomorrow before I can get those into uploaded into the my blog space. And again, that blog space is Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. So you know what? I think, and I may not have mentioned it, I did air this back in January of this year. So this is, again, it's been aired once here on this show. But again, for the reasons I mentioned at the start of the hour, I think it's kind of appropriate and interesting as well, to play it again now. So here we go. And as introduced by Era McCauley, Artistic Director at Kingston Writers Fest, here is the Kingston Writers Fest event called Fire Weather with John Valent, author of his book called Fire Weather, The Making of a Beast. Conversation. And we'll talk about that book and much more. And again, this 90-minute conversation will air uninterrupted. Here you go.
All right. Good evening, everyone. Hard to believe we're at the end of day two of Kingston Writers Fest. Welcome to tonight's event. My name is Era McCauley, and I am the artistic director of the festival, and I'm very pleased to present this conversation, Fire Weather. I'd like to begin by recognizing that our organization is situated on the traditional territory of the Huron-Wendat, Anishinaabe, and Haudenosaunee Confederacy. These indigenous peoples called this land home before the arrival of settlers and still live here now. We acknowledge the presence of these nations and other First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who share this land today. We are grateful to live and work here and acknowledge our responsibility to peaceably share and honor the land, water, and skies of this territory. This event is 90 minutes long and includes a question and answer period. Ushers will have microphones, so please wait for one to be passed to you. We hope you follow the sponsorship acknowledgement videos playing in the hallway. Once again, I would like to thank the Canada Council, Canadian Heritage, Ontario Arts Council, Experience Ontario, City of Kingston, and Kingston Arts Council for their ongoing support of the festival. Thanks too to our festival media sponsors, Your TV, Post Media, Profile Kingston, and CFRC. We are grateful to the many organizations and individuals who support the festival. Kingston Writers Fest would especially like to thank Jennifer Foster of Writer Burbage for Hurley Foster, author patron of John Valiant. I would also like to take a moment to offer a heartfelt thank you to our volunteers. Many of the ones here today I've seen on site all day. So we literally could not do this festival without them. So I'd like to just give a round of applause. I would ask you, if you do have any kind of device that makes noise, double check that you've turned the sound off now. You are welcome to take photos as long as there is no flash. We encourage you to fill out a comment card or complete our online survey at kingstonwritersfest.ca. You can win the entire novel idea window full of festival books. You can also win a festival pass to next year's festival. At the end of the event, I encourage you to please join John at the back of the room to get your book signed. Novel Idea is literally just next door and will be selling books through the event. And now I am pleased to introduce our interviewer for this evening, Warren Mabee. Dr. Mabee is the Associate Dean and Director of the School of Policy Studies. He's responsible for implementing a transition plan that will better integrate the school's activities with policy-relevant teaching and research across the Faculty of Arts and Science, as well as other faculties at Queen's. The Associate Dean also supports the faculty's strategic plan development and implementation and works closely with the Dean's office and department heads to better facilitate inter- and transdisciplinary research and teaching across the facility. Dr. Mabee also supports government relations at Queen's and liaises with provincial and federal government officials to help identify and address areas of strategic policy concern. Warren holds a PhD from the University of Toronto and previously served as head of the Department of Geography and Planning. His research focuses on the intersection of policy and technology in the areas of renewable energy, and he has a particular interest in developing Canada's circular bioeconomy. Please welcome Dr. Mabey.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's great to see everybody out. I've been looking forward to this event for weeks now, and I'm just thrilled that it's here. And thanks so much for that very kind introduction. I wanted to say two things before I introduce our author and before we get into the conversation. First, I really appreciated the land acknowledgement. One of the things that I always say to my students is that Cataraqui, where Kingston sits, has always been kind of a meeting place. This is a place where different nations came together. They came together to hunt and to fish and to share stories and trade things, sometimes to fight, but often just to learn from each other. And to me, that's the most exciting thing, because I like to think we have a community here that is built to learn from each other. I hope we can do a little bit of that tonight. So I wanted to say that. The other thing I wanted to say is that one of the reasons I'm particularly interested in this is that I trained as a forester. So I started off as an actual field forester, planting trees and sometimes cutting trees down and doing all those sorts of things. Forest fire has been part of my, you know, kind of professional career for 30 odd years now. And you know, it's been alarming to see what's been going on. And that's why I'm just so thrilled that we're gonna have this conversation tonight, because I think it's critically important. So let me get to introducing the author, our speaker, John Valiant. So John is a highly accomplished. Thank you. John is a highly accomplished author, and he's written books that you've probably seen or read. The Golden Spruce, which is one that I highly recommend, by the way, talks about the illegal cutting of Kidkias, I think I got that right, which is a golden spruce, a mutant spruce that was growing on Haida Gwaii. It was a sacred tree held in, you know, very high regard by the Haida people who had, you know, seen this tree grow and develop. It was cut by a forester, a forest technician, who was thinking that he was rebelling against, you know, the way that we were doing business in forestry, but he couldn't have picked a worse way to go at, you know, trying to make his point. It was a terrible day, but the book does a tremendous job of describing this. John's won multiple awards, not just for this book, but for many others. He has won awards, including the 2014 Wyndham Campbell Literature Prize in Nonfiction, and Fireweather, which came out earlier this year, has been long listed for the 2023 National Book Award, the Bailey Gifford Prize for Nonfiction, and is on the shortlist for the Hillary Weston Trust Prize for Nonfiction. So this is a book that is... it's being recognized as such a critical piece of work, and, you know, I don't want to say it was good timing, but certainly the events over the summer have hammered home how important it is that we understand this phenomenon that's going on. So would you please join me in welcoming John to the stage for our conversation. Can you hear us? Can you hear me? Yes, okay, good. I did write down a bunch of questions. The format for tonight's event, we're gonna go back and forth a little bit, have a bit of a conversation. I believe John's going to read an excerpt from the book a little bit later on, but we will have time for questions as we get a little bit later in. So as we're going through the conversation, please, you know, think of the questions that you would like to ask. This is a wonderful opportunity to be able to learn and to exchange ideas and to exchange thoughts. So, I've never actually done this before.
Me neither. Yeah.
So I did sit down earlier this week and start jotting down questions. And of course, my first question is, what led you to write this book? Why write this book? Yeah.
Thank you, by the way, for those lovely introduction, and it's really good to be back in Kingston. I was here for the Tiger about 10 years ago, and it's just a really sweet town, and as a former Easterner, it's just really nice to see those maples. It does my heart good. It happened quick, and I think we all saw it. I think we all saw the same thing, that really terrible moment in the afternoon, evening of May 3rd, when video started to come out of Fort McMurray, along with streams of traffic, and we saw this entire city of 90,000 folks, temporary and permanent, completely disappear under this giant fire cloud. And we learned eventually that this fire cloud was about 15 kilometers tall, and it was producing its own lightning, producing its own hail. It was a kind of fire perpetuation system conjured up just by the ferocity of what came out of the forest over those couple of days. And I, journalists were piling onto this thing, as they rightly should. And so I'm used to kind of having the story to myself. I pick things that have happened that people forgot about, and then I can kind of go back and spend my time with them. This was completely different than that. But it felt really urgent, and it really felt like this is the biggest thing to happen in Western Canada in a generation. And as I got to understand, I couldn't help myself. I was working on another project at the time, but started looking into it. And when I noticed, the temperature, 32, 33 Celsius, just out of perverse curiosity, I looked at the relative humidity. It was 11%. And to find a place that's normally 11% humidity, you have to go to Death Valley in Southern California in July. So you had that kind of, and low humidity, that's what dries your clothes. That's what dries out firewood, and it does the same thing to the forest. So you've got 11% humidity in the boreal forest, in one of the wettest ecosystems on Earth, and it's 33 degrees Celsius for day after day after day. There's already 5 fires burning around the city. And yet there were ice on the local lakes. There were car-sized blocks of ice on the Athabasca River. And it created a real dissonance. But I think I understood early, wow, if this can happen, if a fire of that intensity can happen that far north, that early in the season, imagine, what could happen later. And, the terrible heat dome of 2021 that incinerated Lytton, BC, that was still 5 years away. Paradise, California hadn't happened yet. Of course, Lahaina hadn't happened yet. The terrible Tubbs fire in California, I think 9,000 structures burned, 40 people killed. That hadn't happened yet. A whole lot of horrible things hadn't happened yet. But I saw that energy in Fort McMurray, in this very wealthy, well-equipped city full of competent, together people who were on it. They were on it. And yet the fire, the energy, this new energy, what I call 21st century fire, overwhelmed them. And then I kind of understood, okay, this is with us now. And we need to know about it. So honestly, I'll just say it now, I really wrote this book as much as a PSA as anything else. The other books were books. They were, really challenging to write, and I hope they're relevant and resonate and all that. This is an emergency. And we've been seeing it all summer, and I obviously couldn't have anticipated that, but nobody, maybe a hydrologist or a forester saw it coming, but nobody that I know of saw Halifax coming. That's far as most of us are concerned, that's where fog is made, some pretty good beer, some decent music and ocean views and, maybe a cottage, but other than that, for most of us who don't live there, it's not a flammable place. And you talk to the firefighters from, they got an Alberta fire, and that's, if it can happen there, it can happen anywhere. So we're getting indicators, and the lights are flashing right now.
So I very much agree that things are changing and changing rapidly. You spoke about Lytton. We could talk about West Kelowna. We could talk about Yellowknife and the fact that we've had major evacuations and we've had major fires. According to the Canadian Forest Service, about 16.5 million hectares of forest have burned this year. The previous record year was 1989, which was a horrible fire year, tremendous fire year. It was about 8 or 8.5 million hectares. So we're double what the record year was in our records. And there will be people that say, well, you know, if you go back 200 years, there were big fires. And you've written a little bit about some of those historic fires, a little more recent. But certainly what we're seeing is not on the normal curve.
No.
This is well outside the normal curve.
I've got a quick comment about that. You know, I think there have always been colossal fires, especially in the boreal, and that is normal. That's how that ecosystem regenerates. And what we're seeing now, though, is a kind of a compression of these events. And you're also seeing it in terms of floods. You know, it's a 500-year flood. Well, we have actually had two of those in the past 7 years, say in Kentucky, you know, or somewhere. And likewise, for example, California, a huge state with a huge fire capacity for gigantic, terrible fires. 7 of the top 10 fires have burned in the last 3 years. And that is not normal. That's a new, you know, that's 21st century fire. We're in a new regime now. So just to put some numbers on that and stats on that, and likewise, 16 million hectares is about somewhere between Florida, Oklahoma, Uruguay, you know, full, very large places, and that's across Canada.
Yeah, it's sometimes easier for us in Canada to forget how big this is because the country's so big. You know, the boreal forest, which is only a portion of our forest, is about 280 million hectares. So it's not a small, maybe 260, something like that. So it's a very, very large ecosystem. It basically goes from coast to coast, from the Yukon right across into parts of Newfoundland and Labrador. It is a fire-driven ecosystem. And that might be why foresters didn't see some of the warning signs early. You know, we saw fires, but we expected fires. We thought that they would come. We just don't expect fires that look like this.
And, you know, this, one of the things that I kept noticing, one of the indicators of 21st century fire is speed and intensity. And if you talk to people who were run out of Enterprise, Northwest Territories, just a couple of weeks ago, talk to people, you know, in Lahaina, Paradise, Fort McMurray, no one can believe how fast it comes and or what it does when it gets there. And that, I think, is new. And it really comes down to the simple physics of dryness and temperature. And there are these kind of invisible thresholds that we all live with. And we think, well, oh, what a hot and beautiful sunny day today. I'm wearing shorts, you know. Meanwhile, the fire is thinking, and the forest is thinking. The forest is thinking, I've never been this dry, you know, in May. And the fire is thinking, you know, I've never had it so good. You know, there's no resistance. I don't have to dry anything out because everything on the surface is now kindling dry. And so I can just move right along. And the energy release from that fire coming into Fort McMurray, the temperature was that it was so radiant heat. Just bear with me here. Radiant heat is the heat from the candle that tells you not to touch it. And so it's coming off the candle. It moves at the speed of light. And the radiant heat coming out of the forest on May 3rd into Fort McMurray was 500 Celsius across a kilometers wide front. So a man that's hotter than Venus, that's hotter than the planet Venus. So that heat, without fire, just the heat, every tree it hits, flammable or not, desiccates instantly. So it doesn't, may not ignite, but it's now completely devoid of any moisture. So there's nothing to stop it from igniting. Meanwhile, what hydrocarbons also do, and hydrocarbons are almost everything. You know, we have hydrocarbons in our body, you know, our own human body fat. I've got a nice little stash of hydrocarbons right here. And but also, you know, our pants, the rubber soles on our shoes, this carpeting, all of it is hydrocarbons. So when you heat that up, especially to 500 Celsius, it begins to vaporize. It begins to volatilize. So think of a gas can full of vapor. You know, well, there's no gas in there, but we know it's still explosive. We know it's volatile. Well, the reason why fire is hot is to release the hydrocarbons from anything burnable in vapor form. And when you've got 500 Celsius coming into a town that's clad in vinyl siding, covered in tar shingles, illuminated by vinyl windows and full of plywood, you know, all the glues and laminates and mattresses and plastic garbage cans and playground furniture and gas grills and snow tires, all that stuff starts to volatilize. So we can't see it, but what the fire can smell, if you will, is this huge cloud now of billowing flammable gas coming out of this city. And that black spruce would do that too, would burn the same way. But the fire just made this seamless transition into the astonishing number of petroleum products that are not just fueling our cars, but actually building the world for us now. It's really integrated into, you know, we talk about people of the corn, we're really, you know, people of the hydrocarbon. And so that's why the fire burnt houses down in 5 minutes. And, you know, it's an unbelievable speed, but has been confirmed. You know, firefighters were literally setting their watches by the speed of houses, because that determined where they'd set up to try to stop the fire down the street.
And this was something that I really found, I want to say interesting. It sounds terrible to say interesting because it's such a tragedy that we're reading about, but firefighters are used to fighting house fires or building fires, structural fires. At least our city firefighters are. Forest firefighters do operate on a slightly different premise, but something that really jumps out in the book is, you know, this fire jumped into a city. And suddenly it was the city services, the city fire department, that had to manage it. And, you know, one of the things that I ended up thinking at the end of the book was, wow, they really changed up their game in a hurry.
The on-the-ground learning, the on-the-ground adaptation was absolutely extraordinary. And wildfire fighting is sort of a long game. You would almost never confront it directly unless it was a small fire. You're working the flanks, you're trying to work ahead of it, maybe to deprive it of future fuel. It's a whole different regime, different body type, different equipment, different psychology, different training. When it comes into the city, it's sort of more personal and intimate, and municipal firefighters are a little more like a rugby team, you know, or a platoon. You know, they go charging in there, they got the sirens, they got the lights, they got the trucks. There's one building or maybe a couple of buildings or a couple of houses, usually just one, and they gang up on it and they beat it down.
That's right.
And so that's the mentality, and it really works for a house fire, because most fires start from the inside. This fire came from the outside, and it came more like a storm than like a burning sofa. And so they come in all ready to scrap like a rugby team, and there's 100 houses on fire. You know, so what are you going to do? And the heat is just absolutely withering. So all of a sudden, you've gone in there, you know, all your training, you know, it's aggressive, it's tactical, it's really success-oriented. And, you know, and many firefighters said to me, we got our ass handed to us. And that is, it's frightening, but it's also humiliating. You know, it's kind of like, you had one job. You have one job, which is to protect the city. The city now needs your protection. And what are you doing? You're running away and leaving your hoses in the hydrants, because we're too darn busy saving people and getting the people out of Abbasand or Beacon Hill before they burn up. So what you hear in 21st Century Fire is the firefighting operation turned into a life-saving operation. And life-saving is part of the gig if you're a firefighter, but it's that wait, there's this other job that they wanted to do and they simply can't. And so it hurts you. You know, I think it hurts your spirit as a firefighter not to be able to do, because they're there to serve. You know, they do a lot of cooking and eating and movie watching. You know, there's a lot of downtime and polishing and all that. But they're driven to protect the community, and to not be able to do that is hard on a person.
I think that this is one of the lessons that we're learning as we've gone through these events, is just how much of an impact it has, not just on the day, you know, losing the buildings, that's terrible. If lives are lost, that's worse. You know, that's a tragedy right away. But there's many, many years of building back. There's the post-traumatic stress that kicks in. There's the the constant kind of rethinking of your own approach to things. Yeah. How do you do your job?
Yeah.
I want to come back to that, but one of the things I want to get into a little bit, and maybe this goes to the excerpt that we talked about, is how fast it all happened.
Yeah.
Like, you spoke about that right at the very beginning as you were answering the question, but it was so fast.
Yeah.
Like, we went from, there might be a little problem, maybe we should be worried, to disaster.
There's this line from, I think it's The Sun Also Rises by Hemingway, so that book is almost 100 years old now, believe it or not, and there's a line, so, how did you go bankrupt? And the guy says, well, two ways, gradually and then suddenly. And I think that really applies to climate change over the past 50 years. You know, we've seen this coming, and you know, and but also to the Fort McMurray fire. And this excerpt that I happen to have handy here, the paperback's already out. It's a lot thinner, you know. That's a lot of there's a lot of fluff in there, but this one's a lot easier to carry around. In Fort McMurray, May 3rd began differently for everyone, but it ended the same. For Chandra Linder, it began with a rite of spring. Linder was a labor relations advisor who worked for Syncrude. Linder's husband, Corey, an engineer, was employed there too, and so were many of their friends. Blonde, with a pixie cut, Linder is fit and warm and does not suffer fools. It makes sense once you get to know her, but to an outsider it might seem surprising to see someone so polished and female in such a remote, industry-oriented, testosterone-heavy place. And just so to give you an idea, if you haven't been up to site, you know, to the mines and the upgrading plants, the ratio is about 25 to 1, men to women. And if you want to know what it's like to be a woman up there, read Dux by Kate Beaton, a really amazing graphic memoir. So for work, Linder dresses accordingly. Minimal makeup, high collars, dark pants, no heels, clothes suitable for climbing in and out of trucks and SUVs, for working in a world of working men. Linder had already seen the smoke plume southwest of town because everyone had seen it. A windswept cauliflower of billowing grays and browns that appeared to have sprouted full-blown from the forest on Sunday afternoon. It had been growing since then, but it was still many kilometers away, and it wasn't the only one. Over the weekend, the Linders had hosted friends evacuated due to another fire. It was almost a lark. They took photos of the big plume developing across the river the same way one would a sunset or a rainbow. Their friends went home the next day. Because forestry was on it. Boots were on the ground, water bombers were in the air. As far as the Linders were concerned, whatever was out there was being handled, because that's what people do in Fort McMurray. They handle things. Certainly the beginning of May was a little early for fires, but otherwise this was nothing new. Fires cloud the horizon every spring and summer up here. As Chandra and Corey said, practically in unison, it happens every year. Given the unseasonable heat, and the fact that five separate wildfires had ignited around the city that weekend, it's hard to overstate how unconcerned was Fort McMurray's citizenry. But if you were up at dawn on May 3rd, as Chandra Linder was, and you had seen the sky so full of summer promise as she had, you might understand why. The brilliance of that morning was so exceptional, even for Alberta, that after her morning shower, Linder did something she hadn't done in a long time. She pulled out her favorite navy blue suit with the skirt, picked some medium heels to go with it, and left her socks in the drawer. Thus attired, she headed off to work in Syncrude's head office. In her garage, there were a few vehicles to choose from, and in keeping with her outfit and her mood, Linder picked the car she calls the little one. Black Porsche that hadn't seen daylight in 6 months. Winters are long and dark in Fort McMurray, but this one was over,
Spring was here, and Linder felt as beautiful and hopeful as the day. So this is 2016. There was a terrible crash in global oil prices in 2014. So Fort McMurray had been weathering this. The median household income in 2016, 2 years after this really serious decline in global oil prices that really determines the fate of Fort McMurray, 2 years after that, the median household income was $200,000 a year. It's a special place up there. So we're going to jump ahead just about 3.5 hours, May 3rd, mid-afternoon. Still feeling the symptoms of spring fever, Chandra knocked off work at lunch and organized herself for a 2 o'clock meeting at Syncrude's downtown office in the Borealis building. With no traffic, it's a 30-minute drive. Still 20 kilometers north of downtown, she was rounding a long, gradual bend in the river when her windshield filled with something she did not recognize. "When I got that first view of it," said Linder, "I went, hang on a second. It was clear overhead, but to the south, it was black. Black smoke with streaks of red in it. It took up the whole sky. I'm trying to make sense of this thing. I'm thinking, maybe it just looked closer than it is. I'm thinking, maybe the red is the sun shining through smoke. But it's not the sun. It's in the wrong place. And then I realize it's flame." Linder had seen a lot of fire plumes, but this didn't look like any of them. So I pull over to the side of the highway, and I call my guy, Byron, and I say, "Are we having this meeting?" And he's like, "No, we're not having this meeting. Don't come in." And I'm like, "I'm looking at a wall of flames here." It was a short call, in part because no one was quite sure what to say next. What do you say on a beautiful spring day when the city where you live and conduct business appears to be on fire? After hanging up, Linder continued on to her exit, where she turned west, back up the hill and out of the river valley. "Okay," she said, "not right, but here's what I do. I'm gonna go home anyway. I drive past the dry cleaners. Well, I'm gonna drop off my stuff at Sam's place, because in my mind, the fire's still on the other side of the river, downtown. So I'm dropping my stuff off, and this guy comes in from the golf course in full golf apparel, and he's like, 'Holy shit, we just got evacuated from the golf course.' And I'm like, 'Well, what are you doing here?' And he says, 'Well, I'm here to pick up my dry cleaning.' And I said, 'What golf course were you on? Because we have two in town.' And he says, 'Thickwood,' meaning the fire has just jumped the river. The Athabasca River by the Thickwood Golf Course is 0.5 kilometer wide." "So," continued Linder, "Sam, the dry cleaner, who's our buddy, is on the phone to his wife. 'Honey, it just jumped the river. Get out. Get out. Get out.' In all this craziness, Sam still takes my dry cleaning, logs it, and he's like, 'Tuesday good?' And I'm like, 'Yeah. Next Tuesday's great.' At 2 o'clock in the afternoon on May 3rd, Linder tucked her laundry ticket safely in her wallet and aimed the Porsche for home."
What I love about that reading and what it brings is just how fast the situation can change on you and how dramatic that change can be, because, you know, what would any of us do in that sort of situation? It's so hard to imagine a situation where suddenly your city is going to be evacuated, where your home is going to be threatened, because we think of those as incredibly safe places.
Yes.
You know, these are our castles. These
yeah.
are our places. And, you know, this shows you, you know, even if you could see the fire, you weren't really thinking it was going to impact you.
Yeah, yeah. So I interviewed a lot of people up there, including Chandra and her husband, and
These are sensible, rational, together, forward-thinking people. And they're just like us, really, at our best, really. And what they saw, and this happened again and again, as I interviewed a lot of people, you know, how did you become aware of the fire, and what did you do next? And for so many people, it was too big to integrate. You know, our psyches, our lived experience has not prepared us intellectually or really even evolutionarily to take in something that big, that new, that fast, that threatening. And when you consider that, and then you consider the evacuation, the fact that everybody made it out of the flames, it's mind-blowing. And again, you alluded to this earlier, that the incredible adaptations that people had to make on a dime were extraordinary. And it wasn't just firefighters. You know, it was like, well, Junior's at school and Susie's over there, and what about the cat? Well, they figured that all out really, really fast and got out. And, you know, something else to consider, there are 80 first languages spoken in Fort McMurray in 2016. So a whole bunch of religions, whole bunch of different ideas about what authority is, what risk is, what fire means, how to respond. And somehow, you know, despite that, you know, I'm from lefty liberal Vancouver, and, you know, there's news coming out of Alberta that, you know, is questionable and concerning and all of this. And up in Fort McMurray, there's the whole gamut of people. And when things really got dire, the social net closed, and it caught everybody. It didn't select anybody. It didn't abandon. Didn't select for anybody. It didn't abandon anybody. It got everybody, no matter who you were, what language you spoke, what religion you followed, what your politics were. And that's an extraordinary thing. And it did not happen in Lahaina, it didn't happen in Paradise, didn't happen in Lytton, didn't happen in all kinds of places. And a lot of that has to do with the demographic. A lot of it has to do with age. I think the secret sauce probably in Fort McMurray was mostly young people. But there was other stuff going on too. It would have been very easy for an anxious or selfish person, but really just an anxious person, to jump the queue and then cause an accident at a critical intersection, and then you'd have people burned over on the road. Cars were burned over on the road getting out of Enterprise, Northwest Territories. The people survived, the animals didn't. A lot of cars were burned over in Lahaina, in Paradise. And so something amazing happened up in Fort McMurray. And I really hope a sociologist goes up and studies that, because some of it is Canadian, I think. Some of it is, you know, there were authority figures there doing the right thing under incredibly difficult circumstances. So there were traffic cops, you know, in the smoke, barely able to breathe, controlling access to the highway in a way that kept the traffic moving, despite the fact that all the trees were on fire on both sides of the road. So a whole bunch of people stepped up in some amazing ways, but how they batted 1,000 that day. It was perfect. And it was very imperfect in terms of when the evacuation was called. Most people found out there was a fire and that they needed to go because their neighborhood was on fire, or because their husband called them or their wife called them or something. They did not hear it from the authorities. And that's, you know, that bears revisiting and some close analysis. But the folks got themselves together, and between firefighters and police, they all got out. And I also think Canada got a pass. Hundreds of people could have died that day. Hundreds and hundreds, and it would be a completely different story. It would be this, you know, centuries-long black mark on the country if that had happened, and it didn't happen. And I think we can't say, well, we're good, we're lucky. No, this, we got a message. We got a really strong message. And I think one way to honor and respect the people who survived and the people who worked so hard to get people out safely is to look at our own communities and make sure that we don't get caught on the back foot like that. So it really is an amazing, a combination of sort of heroism and culture and humanity, and really, you know, extraordinarily beautiful in its way, but still totally scarring. I mean, a lot of people have PTSD. The one problem with a late evacuation is you're in that terror, and you got your kids in the back seat. You're trying to manage their fear. You're trying to manage your own fear. Paint's blistering on your truck. You know, the windshield's cracking because the embers are so big, hitting the window. Animals on fire, running into you. You know, I mean, it's super hardcore. It's absolutely apocalyptic, and nobody knows. No one could see where it ended. They didn't know where the end was. It wasn't like, oh, I just got to get up to, you know, the Esso station and I'll be good. Well, the Esso station exploded. So nobody knows where it ends, and they had to keep it together for each other, for their kids, you know. And it's, you know, I was in tears a lot writing this, just because a lot of people were in tears to me talking about it. You know, grown men, Fort McMurray dudes, you know, really losing it as they recalled that day for me. You know, super generous thing to do. They didn't have to do that. You know, there's a two-word response to a Vancouver guy wanting to hear about your worst day, you know, and nobody said that to me. So, you know, I'm really grateful for that. And it's, again, it just says a lot for the people of Fort McMurray. I talked to a lot of different kinds of folks.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I took away after reading the book is, you know, there's a really hopeful piece here. Yeah. You know, and I think you're right. We were lucky. There was a lot of luck involved. Something was looking down. There were forces at work maybe that helped us out, but we were lucky because we didn't end up with that horrible black mark. But there were lots of anecdotes. You know, one thing that really stuck with me was the firemen who gave up their filter masks,
yeah,
charcoal filters,
yeah,
to the police officers so they could direct traffic.
Yeah.
You know, like this,
yeah,
is...
this is beautiful.
Yeah.
Over and over again, there was that kind of, you know, really, it just still chokes me up to think about it. And just think of the, again, it's hotter than Venus. You know, so they're trying to stay away from the but when everything is, there's just radiant heat everywhere, the smoke was impenetrable, incredible sounds. A wildfire, a big forest fire sounds like a train or a jet. And then the houses are kind of exploding and the glass is breaking and timbers are snapping. And so there's incredible violence all around you that you can't even see. And you're somehow maintaining your humanity. And this is something that, you know, we watch these zombie apocalypse movies and something terrible happens and then people become these, you know, flesh-eating automatons. And it's actually the opposite. When the world ends locally, the people in Fort McMurray became more human, I think. Their humanity kind of became almost luminous. And they did these generous things. And including just waiting in line. You know, and you know, none of us likes a queue jumper, but when your kids are in the back and they're screaming and there's fire everywhere, you know, you can see why someone might want to jump the queue and say, I see a little gap there, I'm going to go for that. And people generally did not do that. And just think of yourself in that situation under that kind of pressure, and it's like, wow, those are some substantial people. So
one of the big stories that you tell in this book is the story of climate change and the story of Canada's oil industry, the oil sands and the developments there. You talk to a lot of people who work in the industry. I mean, Fort McMurray is full of people that work in the industry. You know, one of the things that I was looking for as I read the book is, you know, were they going to have a different story to tell than maybe people who don't work in the oil industry? Because there's a lot of polarization in Canada about, you know, oil and the future of oil and what we do with oil and whether or not we should be doing anything with oil. I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit. It's not really a question. It's just a big comment. So
it's a massive topic. Mm-hmm. And there are all these different layers to it, you know, and Rich Kruger has a really different motive for being up there. He's the new CEO he's Exxon alum, if you will, now running Suncor, which just sold off its entire renewables business and is planning to fire 1,500 workers as it just had record profits. You know, these folks aren't your friends. They're not our friends. They pay well, but they're trying to pay as less and less people as rapidly as possible. And, you know, one of the people I sat up on the plane with flying in and out of there was an engineer from Liebherr, which is a huge crane and heavy equipment company. He said, yeah, we're up there at site at Suncor testing autonomous vehicles. You know, It's just not about the worker. And people will tell you that it is, and there are political parties that will tell you that it is, and it's not. And that's really painful, and I think people up there know that. But this is their meal ticket. And, you know, I think, too, when you never had any money or you came out of poverty, and the same goes, you know, for writers, you know, when people are offering me money, I don't question where it came from. I'm really glad, like, man, I must have done something good, you know. I must have wrote a really good book. People want to pay me this money. I don't think about who owns the company that's paying me or where the prize money came from, you know. And so it's when things are going your way and when money is coming your way, you know, all of a sudden we're sort of special and lucky, and this, I must deserve this somehow. And if you came out of, you know, some outport in Newfoundland, and, you know, your family's been on the dole for a generation, and you take the big leap and leave the island, already a brave thing to do, and you come back in an F-150, Mom, Dad, look what I did, you know? You also might come back, you know, with an OxyContin habit, you know, and there's a lot of that too. And, you know, it's really hard. It's almost like I feel like young people going to Fort Mac need to have the same kind of counselors that professional athletes do. It's like, okay, buddy, you're going to be coming into a lot of money right now, and here, let's set you up with a savings account and da 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 da. And because a lot of that money got pissed away, frankly, and a lot of it was wasted. And some of it went to mortgages and to give their kids a better life than they had. You know, those are the people who settled in Fort McMurray, but a lot of the rest of it, you know, went up in smoke and different vapors. And so, you know, then what do you have? So as far as where do we go now, what's really painful, that right when I started writing this book, you know, in 2016, these exposés started coming out from Inside Climate, which won a Pulitzer for this work, from the LA Times, from Naomi Oreskes and Jeffrey Supran from Harvard, who started getting, they got access to internal documents from big oil companies. Big oil companies, I mean, think about it. Exxon, Esso, Standard, the biggest, most powerful company in the world in the 60s and 70s and 80s. So you can hire the best scientists. Well, in the late 60s, they started, when CO2 and its connection to fossil fuels started to rise through the noise of other climate concerns, they put their scientists on it. And these folks were crackerjack. And they came out with analyses. You know, if we continue burning at this level and expanding at this rate, this is what we can expect to happen to the climate. People understood what CO2 does to the climate of planet Earth in the 1850s. They knew it already. It's not anything new. And they applied this to the petroleum industry. They came up with some numbers, and they were exactly right. And one thing they predicted was right around 2000, temperature and climate changes are going to start to emerge through the noise of natural fluctuation and become more prominent and more consistent. And that's exactly what happened. You look at any graph of temperature rise, of sea surface temperature, and also fire behavior. And fire started burning differently right around 2000. And the Chisholm Fire of 2001, which burned in Alberta, which no one here has probably ever heard of, that was the hottest fire ever measured on Earth. The hottest fire ever measured on Earth. Produced its own tornado, also a small one. But the kilowatts coming off the leading edge of that fire just blow everything else out of the water. And it was a fire of that kind of energy, that magnitude, just a couple hundred K north of Chisholm that came into Fort McMurray. And that's what's going on right now. And when you look at the charts for just raw kilowatt energy coming off of Canadian fires for this summer, you know, you got these graphs and these charts, and they're kind of angling upward. And then it's someone just basically tied a balloon to the line for 2023, because it just goes like that. And it's still going as we speak. Fires are still burning on a massive scale. So we're in a, you know, we're really in a new place. And we know the connection between fossil fuels and CO2. And so basically, it took me years to get to this, but the only reason we're interested in fossil fuels, you know, besides plastics and things like that, is to burn them, whether it's coal or bitumen or gas or oil, it's to burn it. So if you are in the fossil fuel industry, the petroleum industry, then you're in the fire industry. And if you're in the fire industry, you're in the CO2 industry. There's no way to separate the two. Carbon capture will never work affordably on the scale that we need. And if you're in the CO2 industry, you're in the climate change industry. And Kruger knows that. He's known that. I mean, they've known that since he was a kid. And that's kind of painful to consider, that these companies understood this exactly. They're very smart people, and they made some choices. And there was a very stark moment right around 1980, 84, during the first term of Ronald Reagan, when the American Petroleum Institute kind of got together after looking at these studies, which demonstrated, you know, the connection between fossil fuels and CO2, and they decided to disavow their science. And that's what they've been doing ever since. And so that's, you know, that's a painful betrayal. And it's simply a fact, you know, that I'm not David Suzuki. You know, I don't work for him. I don't have much to do with him. You know, I look at the science, I look at the math, and I read the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal. And even the Wall Street Journal, a big pal of big oil and big money, even they just did an expose on Exxon, of how Exxon delayed and tried to mute climate science awareness. And when the Wall Street Journal does that, you know, I would listen, you know, no matter what party I voted for. You know, those are money people. And so even they're kind of shocked, even though people knew this 30 years ago.
There's a couple more things I want to ask, and then I do want to open up the floor. So be thinking of those questions. We'll do one or two more things, then we'll open up. One of the things I'm curious about is this wildland-urban interface and the role that it plays. And, you know, you have a stat in the book which kind of blew me away, that 50% of Canadians live in what they call the wildland-urban interface. So surrounded by trees, kind of out, you know, into nature. What we saw in Halifax was definitely occurring in that zone. What we saw in West Kelowna, definitely in that zone. I don't know if I would say the same about Yellowknife, but you know, that's a bit of a different
trees
scenario.
Trees are smaller there, yeah.
Trees are a little bit smaller. Can you talk a little bit about that? You have some really great anecdotes about how our ancestors never would have done that. You know, we would have done it differently.
Yeah. So the WUI, W-U-I, rhymes with FUI. It's the wildland-urban interface. Firefighters increasingly are calling it the wildland-urban in-your-face. But is the place where the wildland, the forest, meets the butts up against the built environment. And think about where most of us want to live, especially as Canadians, but you know, most North Americans, we're forest people. A lot of us came from forested places elsewhere in the world. We came here and we love the trees. You know, there's a beautiful comfort, you know, to them. And so we want to live near them. And post-war, as agricultural lands were increasingly abandoned and grew over and people moved into suburbs and people kind of, their relationship changed to woodlands. And it became more of an aesthetic thing rather than a practical thing. And, you know, you want to have, you know, a running trail for mom out the back, and you want to have a basketball court in the cul-de-sac, you know, for junior in the front. And that's where a lot of us have been moving or visiting, you know, friends and family. And so what that's it. And Stephen J.